Mary Roach is the author of 5 best-selling works of nonfiction, most recently Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Her writing has appeared in Outside, National Geographic, and the New York Times Magazine, among many other publications. Her newest book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, which is an investigation into the unpredictable world where wildlife and humans meet. Again, the name of the book is Fuzz. Mary Roach is the author, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Mary Roach back to this program. Thank you very much for being with us. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We always love having you on the show. I think you've been on for just about every book. Mary is the author of Gulp and Stiff, just to name a few, and the new one is Fuzz. So what brought you to this particular topic?
Well, I was doing my usual groping around for a new book topic, and I had been I'd gotten interested in wildlife forensics, but originally I was thinking from the other side, like, you know, with wildlife being the victims, like trafficking endangered species, and the forensics specifically of that. It's kind of a long story, but that proved to be a dead end because I couldn't go along on any open cases that were being investigated, which doesn't work for me. I like to be on the scene. You know me. I like to be kind of in the midst of things, have characters and dialogue and all of that fun stuff. So I kind of flipped it around at one point and thought, well, what about if the wildlife were the perps and the people were the victims? Obviously, these are not actual crimes. You know, our laws pertain to us. They commit manslaughter. They jaywalk. They trespass. They vandalize, and we can't throw the book at them. So what do we do? And so because I'm a science writer, I looked at researchers and people who are trying to basically prevent these conflicts and resolve them. So did a fair amount of traveling, looking at how different cultures deal with it. And but human-wildlife conflict, I guess if you had to boil it down to 3 words, is kind of what the book's about. But I got interested in it in just a roundabout way. I don't really have one of those tidy origin stories like I was attacked by wolves. When I was a child, I was carried away by wolves.
So give us a sense. Now, the people that you follow along for this book is really fascinating because I assume there were people that did this. I didn't know they had titles, but they have really cool titles. So an animal attack forensic investigator, a human elephant conflict specialist, bear managers, danger tree faller blasters. So give us a sense of what they have in common and the type of work that they do, because it would seem that that calling would be rather rare in the sense of that there's just so many times that you're going to need an animal attack forensics investigator.
Yes, that given that in the United States, on average, we have about between 0 and 3 fatal bear attacks per year, that would be, it'd be kind of hard to make a living. So these folks, somebody who's a predator attack response specialist, this person typically works for a wildlife agency like Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife, and they all have different variations on that title. A lot of the folks that I was in contact with who did that particular work, they get a certificate, they take a training course and they become certified as somebody who can go into the scene of the crime, as it were, and try to figure out, you know, what species did this attack? Can we identify which individual animal? So they're people who work for agencies, and every now and then there's call for them to make use of their very special and very specific skills. Yeah.
How did you find them? How were you? I assume that you have a track on these folks who, when you come up to a subject and you open up this box, you can say, oh, okay, all right, these are the people that you need to talk to.
Oh, you know, I just make a pest of myself. I'm anytime I'm speaking to one person, I'm saying, you know, who else should I talk to? Who would you suggest I talk to? And so I'm constantly just turning over rocks and asking questions and, you know, what else? What else might I do? Who else might I talk to? So once you step into a world like this, I mean, it's a human wildlife conflict is a it's kind of a small world, and people know the terrain pretty well. So just getting on the phone with one person and asking some questions and asking their input and suggestions helps a lot.
Let's take the example. Chapter 4 of the book is A Spot of Trouble. What makes a leopard a man-eater? So when you say, okay, why did this leopard eat somebody, then what are you most interested in?
I'm interested in why that leopard ate somebody, you know?
So meaning that it's so much, not so much, I mean, you assume the leopard was either under attack or hungry, but why would the leopard be in close proximity to a human, right? I mean, all of this comes together.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I wanted to spend a little time in India because they have a little bit of a different approach than we do here in the States. But I was fascinated by the leopard issue because here in the United States we have big cats, we have mountain lions or cougars. But it's very rare that they attack a human. We're just not on the menu. You know, a decade or more will go by in California where no one is killed by a cougar, though they're all over. You know, they're in all of our counties, and about 5,000 in the state. Whereas in this region of the Himalaya, just specifically this one region, leopards have started preying on people, and often small children. So, and that's not something that they do in other parts of India. In other parts of India, there may be a sort of if you surprise a leopard, it may be defensive. There may be sort of a quick tussle, and then the animal will run off. It's very rare that they will prey on people. But in this region, these villages that I went to, that is happening. So the question was, why? Why did they start looking at us as dinner when they didn't used to, and so looking, trying to get at those reasons, which I talk about in the book, which are, you know, there's one theory from long ago and a couple of factors that are going on now in that area.
I was fascinated by some of the cultural aspects here. You write in the book that while in the United States there's people who often will take the matter into their own hands, like in California, if there are bears who go into these culvert traps, that people feel that it's awful that the bear has been trapped, and then they will release the bear, whereas in India, they're actually angry that these animals are killing human beings.
Yeah, because these are the leopards that we were talking about. You know, these are small villages, and everybody knows when there's a victim, it's a family member often. So people, there's a lot of emotion attached to that. And the government tends to, there's more of a three strikes rule there. You know, if there seems to be a pattern with this animal, then the government will send somebody in, or people can bring somebody in to shoot the animal. But you can imagine in a small village where, you know, a child has been, they want something done. They don't want another person taken. I mean, and the attacks are so much more frequent than they are here. I mean, a bear, there's so many bear encounters that people have, which are completely benign. I mean, it's very, very, bears don't prey on people. They sometimes have, defensive, they feel threatened, and there may be, especially if the person has a dog and the dog gets into it with the bear, you know, things can go south quickly, but it's so rare, and it's not a predatory situation. Here we have, you know, it's almost like the politics here. It's very polarized. There's people, like you said, who feel that under no circumstances should a bear be put down. That if it's a public safety threat, that's something we accept the risk, and that the bear shouldn't be harmed. And there's other people, a bear walks through their yard and they're like, get the rifle. You know, there's two very different extreme feelings, and plenty of people in between on that issue. But it's just very regional, and depending on, you know, the culture in which the person is brought up.
Mary Roach is our guest. The name of the new book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. How did you come to that title, Fuzz?
Oh, well, originally the book we were going to call the book, I was going to call the book Animal Vegetable Criminal.
Is a play on
animal vegetable mineral.
Yeah,
I know, I love
I like that
title. I basically wrote the book around the title. So fast forward to right before we're about to get ready to go to press, and I found out, my editor sends me a chagrined email letting me know that Mark Bittman, who's a major the New York Times food and cooking writer, author, he put out a history of food called Animal Vegetable Junk.
All right.
We had to change the title. Fuzz, Fuzz, because like Fuzz, it's more keeping with my brand, if you will, if I have a brand, you know,
gulp,
one
stiff,
word.
Gulp, sure.
Stiff, yeah. Spook, grunt, bonk. So, yeah, I mean, it's that kind of word, and it makes sense in that way. But I was kind of excited about having 9 syllables. It was going to be a real departure for me. I was
Yes, it is exciting to have 9 syllables. You know, as I was reading the book, I remember this thing that happened. It was a number of years ago, and I was with my family, and we were in Yellowstone National Park, and we were driving along the road, and we see one or two cars parked along the side of the road, and we slow down, and you look up on the hill, and there is a mom bear and a cub next to the mother bear. And we look at it, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful sight. It's a beautiful park. And you think to yourself, oh, that's lovely. What a great sighting. And then I see a woman and her child get out of the car, and she's directing the kid to go up and stand next to the bear and bear child so that she can get a picture of them. And with that, a park ranger pulls up behind us, and the lights are on, and he gets out, and he puts on his hat, and just that look of like, oh my God, really, another one? I got to do this again? Stop people from going to take a picture next to the bear? And I thought, well, good Lord, you know. So I was interested in your book because it is, while I was reading it, just thinking about, you know, we're stupid when it comes to our reaction often with these animals, to even think that they're so far removed sometime from that idea of nature. So when nature breaks the law, you have to wonder what happened to precipitate it.
Yeah, it's very, I have a hard time when I see videos like that. And social media and TikTok and selfie sticks and all of that has further encouraged people. People see someone else's video and they're like, oh, look at the nice little bear. It's like a teddy bear.
Yeah,
I'm going to do that too. Or people leave food out on the deck of their vacation rental because they want to take a video of a bear. They want the bear. They want a close encounter. And what they don't apparently realize, despite all of the outreach by park rangers and wildlife agency people, is that the more bears habituate to people and get used to human handouts, the more time they spend in close contact with us and they realize we don't pose a threat, then their natural wariness goes away, and that shyness gives way to boldness, and eventually that can become aggressiveness. If you've got food that the bear wants and the bear can just, you know, barge in and take it, literally bears go into people's dining rooms and grab food off the table. And they wouldn't do that if they hadn't learned gradually that there's a lot to be gained here and that they can get it and there's very little risk involved. And then, you know, it's going to be the situation the same way that a burglar breaks into a house. And they take stuff and it's fine unless somebody's there, and then the person is there and that somebody freaks out, and then somebody's got a gun or claws in the case of a bear, and teeth, and right. Eventually somebody gets hurt, and it's usually the bear, because once a bear starts getting aggressive and breaking in, it's considered a public safety threat and it's killed. So these bears that learn, oh, if I can pop this minivan open and get what's inside, you know, and they keep doing it and they teach their cubs, and then that becomes a problem bear, and the problem bear is eventually a dead bear. And I know people don't all realize that. They just want to get close to bears. That's the sad irony, is that people love these animals and they want a close encounter. They want to be close to nature. It's just this sad irony that ends up being why so many of these bears are killed.
So when you focus on nature's lawbreakers, these animals really aren't the enemy. They're not the devil here. They're not the bad guy in the story. It's they're doing what they do, right?
They're just animals being animals. They're looking for food, or they're looking for a warm place to make a nest and have their babies. And sometimes that's your attic. Yeah, so they're animals being animals. And unfortunately, they're doing it on a person's property or with that person close at hand. And that's when things become a conflict. And usually it's the animal that fares poorly as a result. So yeah, and a lot of it is, you know, I was going to say it's more our fault than the animals, but really it's just we're sharing the same turf. You know, our range is expanding, if you will. We're going from the suburbs to the exurbs to rural areas. You know, cities are growing, so we're moving out into land that used to be mostly just inhabited by animals, and animals ranges are expanding too. Bears have made quite a recovery from, you know, the 1800s and first half of the 1900s, where they were killed pretty extensively with bounties and poisons and traps. Bears, wolves, coyotes, all of them. So these animals have happily made a nice recovery, but now they're sort of crossing into the point where there's a lot of conflict with the people whose turf they're, you know, whose turf is it really? You know.
Now, so, it wouldn't be a Mary Roach interview if we didn't talk about something gross. So let me ask you about defensive vomiting.
Oh, thank you for asking me about defensive vomiting.
You're welcome.
Nobody has asked me about defensive vomiting yet. So, yeah, okay. So defensive vomiting, this is something that came up in the chapter about gulls. Because people know gulls get into people's business quite a bit. And if you make a gull sufficiently nervous, as researchers sometimes have cause to do, it will vomit. And this is a defense. And I was puzzled by this. First, I thought, well, maybe it's so that they throw up so they're lighter and they can fly away faster.
Right.
And the researcher said, no, that's not it. And I said, oh, I get it. It's just to disgust the person you think may attack you. And she said, no. It's actually, the thinking is that they're providing an alternate food source. Like, don't kill and eat me. Here's this delicious, partially digested, smelly stuff. Wouldn't you rather have that for dinner?
Yeah, it's a different perspective. The gull perspective.
Exactly. Gulls, vultures do it too. Yeah, defensive vomiting. You could try it too.
So now tell us a little bit about the gulls and dealing with them at St. Peter's.
Yeah. I went to Vatican City. The Vatican every Easter puts on this massive outdoor Sunday Mass in the morning. The Pope comes out on the balcony above St. Peter's Square and says Mass to about, I don't know, 50, 60, 70,000 people. And as part of that, there's this huge floral display that is set up on the steps to the altar and all around the altar. You know, like three big refrigerated semis come down from the Netherlands with flowers that are set up over the course of a day. It's a massive undertaking to set up all of these flowers, 6,000 daffodils in pots. So a couple of years ago, after they'd set all of this up, the night before, at around 4 in the morning, these gulls fly in and just wreak havoc, not eating them. Gulls will eat just about anything, but they're not big eaters of plants. Daffodils, in fact, I think are poisonous. So it wasn't that they were hungry. They just, they'll cut roses strewn around and daffodil pots knocked over. So the florist the following year, you know, didn't want to, because it was a lot of work to try to clean it up before the people came in a couple hours later. So he hired a man who has invented a laser scarecrow, which is a, it doesn't actually look, it's not like sticks with clothing and hay, like a classic right. scarecrow. It's a box. It's sort of more like a laser light show. And these laser beams go all around the plants. So they're, the beam is hitting on all the areas that have the plants. And lasers seem to freak birds out. There's a lot of variation. Depends on the color of the laser, the species of the bird. Anyway, it seemed to be, something that they felt that they should try. So they brought in two laser scarecrows and set them up. I was there for the whole situation. It was, quite a lot of nerves that night. Will the gulls come back?
A lot of praying, assume. Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of praying. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that was what the Pope was praying about that night.
Yeah, at the end of the book, and we'll end here, at the end of the book, you have a section called The Fuzzy Trespasser. This is the end of the book, but it's resources for homeowners. And basically, you do give ideas of how resources that people can go to help the animals out so that you don't have to do anything drastic.
Yeah, that's right. There's some really good resources that the Humane Society of the United States and others have. It goes species by species. It's on the website. You can look it up, whether it's raccoons or possums or some kind of bird nesting in your eaves. things you can do that are humane.
Well, it's always...
And also to prevent the conflict, too.
Yeah.
To
not get yourself in that position in the first place.
Exactly.
It is always a pleasure to talk to you, Mary Roach. The new book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. The book is out from Norton. I congratulate you on the new book. I thank you very much for being with us once again, and a delight to speak to you as always.
Oh, my pleasure, Joe. Thank you so much for having me back.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Mary Roach is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.